plate a potential nugget.
And you've spoken about this a couple of times in this conversation, and you refer to this in the book as well. You talk about how we connect to our body. You mentioned that we should treat this as a source of knowledge and support rather than see it as a vehicle that carries us around. Mm-hmm. Again, I found that super nuanced. Give us the insight here. What can we learn by observing our body, and how does that help us become better leaders?
I mean, there's this way that many of us have been taught over centuries in our cultures, in our societies, that the mind is the great thing and the body is sort of the source of temptation or misleading data. And so we've learned to not trust or believe what our body tells us and really think that it's the mind that is the most glorious human achievement. Actually, when we look at sort of our psychobiology, our body is giving us signals all the time that our mind is making sense of very, very quickly, and often reacting to without noticing that it was an embodied sensation that we were reacting to. So if we give someone, some studies that are greater, like if you give somebody a shot of adrenaline and then you have them meet a stranger, depending on the gender of that stranger, they're either likely to be more drawn to that person as a love interest or more threatened by that person as a possible threat or enemy after this shot of adrenaline than they were under normal circumstances. And they tend to attribute that to the other person, right? And they don't attribute that to their bodies in any way. And so their body is giving them a signal, and then they're acting out of that signal without ever noticing that the signal happened. This is very dangerous, right? That we're responding to data by taking action in a way that's completely divorced from our seeing of the data in the first place. So we need to get much more in touch with what our body is telling us. I see leaders all the time, and you see there are studies about this as well. People who go into meetings hungry, because leaders I work with are very busy, and they hate all the ideas. Like, they hate all the ideas on the table. None of the ideas are quite right. Well, is this about the quality of the ideas, or is this about the fact that you didn't have time for lunch? Like, we don't tend to think, oh my goodness, I hate these ideas because I have no blood sugar and I have no creativity left. But actually, this is the way our bodies work. You know, there's fabulous studies of the thing that makes you most likely to get parole when you are in front of a parole board in prison is how close to a break the judges are when they look at your case. If you're right after they ate lunch or breakfast, then you're very likely to get paroled. If you're right before it's time for a break or a meal, you're very unlikely to get paroled. Now, this has nothing to do with the merits of these cases. Right? This is completely because the judges are responding to a bodily sensation, but they don't know that they're responding to a bodily sensation. So they think they're responding logically. If we're more in touch with our bodies, we can avoid those mistakes.
Got it. Now I'm smiling to myself here as we speak. My wife uses the term hangry.
Yes, right. Like, this is a very clever way of understanding a signal that your body is giving you so that you don't blame other people for it.
Got it. No, but one is clearly the stomach and the hunger. But are there other common bodily signals that you see leaders missing? Are there one or two things that stand out for you apart from hunger, which you spoke about?
Oh, absolutely. Anxiety. Anxiety is huge, right? When we feel anxious, we make more protective decisions, we make more short-term decisions. And many organizations have leaders rushing so quickly from meeting to meeting, from crisis to crisis, that leaders spend a lot of their time anxious and not noticing that they're anxious. It's just like their regular way of walking through the world. They don't even notice that they're stressed or anxious, which is why mindfulness has come roaring into organizations, right? Because actually it gives you a moment to notice what's going on inside you, which then helps you decide, oh, how do I want to How do I want to relate to this thing that's going on inside me? If I had a bad meeting an hour ago and it made me anxious, and then I come into this meeting now and I haven't dealt with that anxiety, I'm going to be ruled by this sort of short-term fear-based narrow vision that anxiety produces in the brain and in the body, with this cortisol that rushes through my bloodstream. And I'm going to act out of that place, probably without even noticing that I was anxious because of a thing that happened just now.
And maybe just to understand this further, Jennifer, even if we take anxiety, one would think it's a feeling or a signal to be processed from the mind. How do you think of this as a signal from the body? How does one listen to that signal?
You can notice, what does it do to your body, right? You can notice, like, what does anxiety show up as? Or are your palms sweating? Is your heart beating? What's your breathing doing? Do you clench your thighs or your belly under these circumstances? Like, we can tune into, what are the signals I'm getting? Because the mind rationalizes things, right? Like, the core of this book is that we're constantly rationalizing the decisions we're making, the data we're processing. And so we can't just believe that we've got access to it. We need another set of clues, and figuring out what's going on in our body is very useful. The best way to process anxiety, by the way, is to exercise. So we actually want to burn it off. These hormones are in our bloodstream. And it's one of the problems with this lockdown right now, is how are people able to sweat out the anxiety that they're feeling versus how much are they just having this build up in them? Because anxiety is also particularly bad for long-term health, and it's bad for our immune systems. It's bad for our mental and physical health. So being more connected to what's going on in your body is extraordinarily helpful in complexity.
The big takeaway for me here is the point Jennifer makes about several leaders being anxious and running from meeting to meeting without realizing they're anxious. I realize in the coaching work I do, the biggest unlock is often in enhancing the self-awareness of the leaders and opening up some of these blind spots. A very similar point came up in my conversation with Matthew Walker, a sleep researcher at University of California, Berkeley, and the author of Why We Sleep. We spoke about how sleep-deprived people are like drunk people. They don't actually quite know how drunk they are.
So in studies where we take individuals, and these are studies done by lots of other sleep researchers, where we take individuals and we will start to give them different doses of insufficient sleep, let's say putting them on a week of 7 hours of sleep, or 6 hours of sleep, 5 hours of sleep, 4 hours of sleep. And over that week or that 2 week period, gradually we see cognitive impairment. Typically we see these, what we call cognitive lapses, or these microsleeps. And what's interesting is that we can objectively assess how impaired you are when you are dealing with insufficient sleep. But we can also then ask you as a participant, how are you feeling right now? And what do you think your performance was like on that last test? And we can keep asking that question. So we have an objective measure of your performance, and then we have your subjective assessment. And unfortunately, what we find is that your subjective perception of how well you're doing with insufficient sleep is quite a miserable predictor of objectively how you actually are doing with insufficient sleep. Translated, it actually just means that you don't know you're sleep deprived when you're sleep deprived. And the analogy would be a drunk driver at a bar. You know, maybe they've had 5 or 6 drinks, and they stand up and they pick up their car keys and they say, look, I'm fine to drive home. And your response is, no, I know that you think subjectively that you're fine to drive home, but trust me, objectively, you're not. You're impaired. And unfortunately, that's the same way with a lack of sleep. And that's one of the reasons why I think the public, in addition to perhaps the science not being well communicated by someone like myself, that's another reason why I think people think that sleep is perhaps a luxury and it's negotiable, when in fact, unfortunately, it's not a luxury. It's a non-negotiable biological necessity.
I realize that I'm actually a lunatic when I'm sleep deprived. Now, when I go back to my days in IIM Ahmedabad, the nickname I was given was because of my neurotic response to lack of sleep during one of the early days where we were all required to pull an all-nighter. It took me a few years to really recognize it and work around it. The related point I'd like to make is that as a result, it's also important to focus on how we manage our energy rather than how we manage our time. When are we doing our most productive work? How we plan our day needs to be in sync with when we are at our best, and how our body responds is a big part of the equation. I would say now is a great opportunity for us to architect our days in line with what gives us energy, given we have the ability to manage or sculpt our schedules given our unique bespoke contexts. Thank you for listening. For more content across 50 plus speakers, 500 plus nuggets, painstakingly curated across 65 odd themes, please visit playtopotential.com. You can also find the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcast Player, and most other podcast platforms.